Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another one of these interviews that I'm doing. This is the first one I've conducted in my smoking jacket. I haven't had a cigar for more than a week, Mike, and given that we're going to be talking for some time, I thought it would be worth tucking into a Wine Affairs number one. I'm here with Mike from Imperium Press. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, and I'm glad that you're back onto the cigars for this podcast. if I'm right about what I think I'm right about, then you're going to at least need a cigar. So, yeah.
Well, get them while I can, right? If you're truly right, there'll come a point where I can't get them anymore.
Right.
And quite stupidly, as I was saying before I came on air, I forgot my lighter, so I've got a candle. I've got a candle if I need a quick light. Anyway.
We are going back to the Iron Age with this one.
So you have a new book out written by yourself. What is the title of that book?
So the book is called Tribal Future of the West. This is a book that has been sort of gestating for quite a long time. And as my co-host of one of my podcasts on the Hearthfire Radio Network told me, he crystallized it when he said that this has kind of been something that Imperium, like the thesis in my book, has been something that many of the Imperium releases, at least for the last year and perhaps since the beginning, have been building to for quite some time. For example, with the Mosca book, with the wonderful piece of fiction that we released called The Werewolf, and a number of other things that have sort of come out, including some of the elite theory stuff, but also going back even to The Ancient City and some of the early books that we put out in Chris Bond's Nemesis. And that is basically ideas about the devolution of sovereignty away from state structures or official structures, and sovereignty kind of leaking into unofficial, unofficial places, like, you know, places outside of the mainstream state or the center. And yes, I think it's a book that's going to make everybody mad, especially nationalists. But it is something I think that we have to think about. So, yeah.
So, I mean, just to set this up a little bit, I remember in, you know, the elite theorists, I think it's Robert Michels in particular, talks about the tendency in history towards centralization. But then after a certain amount of over-centralization, there's a countervailing tendency towards what he calls feudalization. This idea is in Mosca as well. I think Mosca talks about it. And you can kind of, I mean, the classical examples are when a big empire breaks up, let's say the Roman Empire, it doesn't simply just collapse. It devolves into, you know, several or lots of smaller self-autonomous regions. And I remember, Mike, going back to my libertarian days, this sort of stuff was more popular. Do you remember when everybody was reading Hans Hermann Hopper, right? He had this idea of the land of 1,000 Liechtensteins, right? So this sort of thing was popular at one point with the anarcho-capitalist crowd, the idea of kind of, you know, the breakdown of empire into balkanization and self-autonomizing regions. You can see why that would be attractive to the kind of anarcho-capitalist crowd, or the Mises lot, etc. Can you elaborate further on, like, is this going to happen? I mean, I noticed you during the book you reference David Betts and you even acknowledge him. I've had a couple of run-ins with David Betts, as you know, because he keeps on predicting there's going to be a civil war or some sort of civil conflict, like the Northern Ireland conflict here in Britain. I honestly don't see that on the horizon. And I also think that people, as it pertains to Britain right now, underestimate the extent to which the British state is still pretty strong and increasingly totalitarian, to be honest. So yeah, maybe you can brook that by way of the explanation as to what's, you know, what is the overall idea of where you think things are going, as you describe it in this book. Cool.
Sure. So yeah, I mean, just to mention David Betts off the top, when I first saw him come onto the podcast circuit earlier this year, he was saying a lot of things that, that marry up very nicely with some of the things that I have been saying for quite a long time, a few years now. And some of what he was saying, you know, helped me to frame this in terms of, you know, for example, there's a chapter devoted to the classical insurgency model as laid out by Mao Zedong, which is something like I got from him. But he was really sort of a confirmation of something that I had been working on independently for some time. So I'll lay that out before we can talk a little bit about, you know, the likelihood of civil war and dramatic collapse and all that. So basically what the book argues is that the modern West is and has been for some time now undergoing a progressive devolution of sovereignty, as I mentioned initially, from large centralized nation states toward a kind of more of a mosaic of localized and personalistic, and we could even say tribally organized authorities. So this is happening for a number of reasons. One is that centralization in the West has reached a point now of diminishing returns. The modern nation state, especially in the post-1945 form, like basically the form that James Burnham lays out, it relied on a number of factors which are no longer in place or are rapidly attenuating. One of those is a robust industrial capacity. Another one you could point to would be substantial elite cohesion. Another one that has been completely exploded is a unified epistemic environment. You could point to something like high social trust or a common national identity. Each of these things has basically eroded. And we are now moving into a situation where things are going to start to change very quickly. Now, the thing about the thesis is that it's framed in terms of elite theory. I believe that what I'm doing is actually the... I think it's the sort of end state of elite theory as applied to the facts on the ground. When you look at what's happening, when you zoom out and take the broader sort of historical view within an elite theory lens, this is what you get. Because sovereignty, now I regard elite theory as basically a continuation of theories of absolutism. So I draw on people like Schmitt, on Juvenal, on even people like Ibn Khaldun and many of the prophets of doom that you mentioned in your book, as well as, you know, people like Joseph Tainter. Basically, what happens when these central institutions lose their capacity and also their legitimacy is that sovereignty, which we know is basically decisionism, flows into intermediary structures. This is, you know, you could think of the center, intermediaries, and periphery of Chris Bond's, you know, his framework. As these centralized institutions lose their capacity, sovereignty flows into these intermediary structures. And these include even things outside of the legal order, like criminal syndicates or militias or fortified enclaves, and things that are within, of course, within the legal order as well, like diasporic networks, digital communities, and the like. Now, what seems to be happening is that certainly outside the West, but I think also increasingly within the West, that these entities are actually performing governance functions without the official titles, things like taxation, adjudication, the provision of security, even things like welfare distribution. These are things that are always traditionally monopolized by the state. And I call these quasi-sovereign actors in the book para-sovereigns. And they seem to be becoming ever more belligerent and willing to flex in the modern era. And what is driving this? This is not, you know, we could think of it as a lack of political will or the inability of elites or the incompetence of elites. And it is those things, but it's actually more fundamentally a structural problem. There are a number of factors that are collectively pushing power outside of the center. One of these, which I've discussed extensively on my Substack, is what I call the epistemic divorce, which is the fragmentation of truth into echo chambers, essentially. Another one, which I take directly from Peter Turchin, is elite overproduction. This is something.
Sorry to interrupt, Mike. What did you call it? The epistemic breakdown. I mean, this is kind of what Scott Adams is called, like, you know, same movie playing on two different screens. You know, people just literally live in different realities now. In America, for example, I mean, imagine you're like a Q believing full on MAGA guy versus your blue haired lesbian. They are literally living in completely different worlds, even though they're the same events are happening. They're watching the same movie, but they're seeing two completely different things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's another word that has been used to describe this, at least in normative terms, and that is celebration parallax, right? Where you see the same thing happen, but one side says, and that's a good thing, and the other says, and that's a tragedy, right? This sort of a disagreement on the normative implications of the facts. But it's even deeper than that. We're disagreeing on the facts themselves. And we saw this in the post-truth era, the advent of post-truth with, Trump 2015. This was the beginning of the epistemic divorce. And by divorce, you think of maybe two sides, and that's certainly what it began as, but I think it's going to continue into a full-on epistemic balkanization. Because, of course, the radical right doesn't really share a lot of common ground with the, you know, mainstream conservative right. I would say communists, although I do regard them on an ideological continuum with left liberals, they are certainly opposed in many ways. What we're seeing with the epistemic divorce is a full-on fragmentation, ultimately. And this is a very interesting turn of events, given the long-term trend towards consolidation of epistemic spaces. But that's changing for material and structural reasons. And so that's one of the drivers.
Sorry to interrupt again, but is that simple as the change from TV to internet?
That's a big part of it. That's absolutely a very, very large part of it. Another driver, which predates the internet, is the advent of postmodernism and poststructuralism. We now, and have for generations now, come to suspect grand narratives. Ultimately, what this is growing out of is the Enlightenment. Enlightenment rationalism and the enshrining of the individual as the moral and epistemic authority above all, when the individual is the supreme authority, you know, the supreme law unto himself. It's quite natural that epistemology is going to balkanize for obvious reasons, right? Because, each of us now is the ultimate arbiter of truth and the ultimate arbiter of good. So this will very naturally lead to a kind of centrifugal force that's pushing people apart. I believe it has more ancient roots than the Enlightenment. But the Enlightenment's a good proximate sort of historical origin point. At least it's one of the real serious signposts along the way. So this epistemic divorce is one factor. I'll just sort of run through the other ones, and then we can talk about them in turn, just to wrap up the overview of the thesis. So this centrifugal drift of authority is being driven by that. It's also being driven by elite overproduction, which Turchin speaks about, and you've spoken about as well. I believe it's in the Prophets of Doom. Another aspect that's driving this centrifugal devolution is the asymmetry of conflict. So the generations of warfare have advanced through the last few centuries. The first few generations asymmetrically favored strong centralized states, but the latter generations have very, very quickly turned that around, and now it's actually small dispersed actors that are able to be more agile and more efficient and ultimately to wage a war of attrition against centralized states. You know, we're thinking of things like guerrilla warfare, information warfare, and that sort of thing. Another aspect, and this may be one of the truly insoluble ones, is the diminishing material capacity in the West. We're seeing a logistical and an industrial contraction on a civilizational scale. This is being driven by the exhaustion of cheap energy. Liberalism, far from being the most efficient way to run an economy or a society, was actually a civilizational luxury, in my view. It relied on high-density energy inputs, which have now been exhausted. And the exhaustion of this, you know, basically the diminishing of energy return on investment has now pulled the rug out from under all the things that we, you know, basically took for granted for a very, very long time. You know, things like, you know, institutional legitimacy, voluntarism, the competent bureaucracy, financialization of the economy, and things like that. I think that these are things that we can afford. They are not necessarily inevitable things toward which they're not the end of history. These are things that have a shelf life and that depend upon a thermodynamic base, which has now been exhausted. Another driver here is the criminal insurgency of these parasovereigns, which I touched on before. And of course, the collapse of the mass mediated civic narratives that have now weakened national cohesion to the point where we kind of don't even have nations anymore. On paper, something like America exists, but you know, in practice, it is now starting to become a network of contending states that don't all obey the directives of the center, and which are waging lawfare against each other. And anyway, there's a number of these forces. I've just kind of sprinted through a few of them, and they mutually reinforce this problem of devolution. Now, I also go through in the book, I'm not sure if you got to this point in it, but I acknowledge and I go through the countervailing centralizing forces. And mm-hmm. The upshot here is that these centralizing forces can delay, but they cannot reverse the devolution, because they are not actually treating causes, they're treating symptoms. So anyway, the overarching thesis, to wrap it up finally, is that the West is entering, as you mentioned, a neo-medieval phase, I believe, a kind of political ecology that will be characterized by things like patchwork authority, hybrid governance, overlapping jurisdictions, negotiated sovereignty. And I also believe that you are about to see in the next few generations the resurgence of tribal structures as the default units of social organization, because in an environment of low legitimacy and low social trust, this is the human default. So this is a kind of reconfiguration of political order along lines that you see recur all throughout history. Sovereignty is now relocating into alternate spaces. So I guess that's the sort of overview of the book.
Really interesting. Well, I've got a lot of questions, Mike. Maybe what I'll do is I'm going to play my little trivia advert, and in the 40 seconds, I'm going to try to formulate these questions in a way that's coherent. But I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to start at the end and work backwards up through your points, just to get a few points of clarification. But sure. Yeah, I'm going to buy a course, everybody. Buy Mike's book as well. What's it called again?
Tribal Future of the West.
Tribal Future of the West. Maybe I'll throw in a picture of it or something when I put this out. I'll put it on the front cover. How about that? And yeah, when I come back, we're going to continue with this interview.
Academic Agency.
All right, so where were we? Let's start with this idea that things will, you know, you're going to start getting local sovereigns again, a refeudalization, you know, aspect of local justice coming in, things like that. I mean, classically, we'd think about something like mafia, wouldn't we, Mike? We'd think, I mean, this was part of your journey to come to these conclusions, was reading Mosca's book, What is Mafia? But can we think about tangible examples of this happening? And just before we start thinking about these examples, I was... a while back, I went back to Wales, spent a week with my parents, and my mother was telling me all sorts of stories about where she grew up, you know, in an old, you know, one of the old mining towns in South Wales. And she was explaining what daily life was like and how, basically, if there was transgressions against the local community in that little town in Wales, the men would literally just take matters into their own hands. She gave one story, for example, when, you know, a teacher came to her in school and it was a little bit too vehement. Her dad just went round there, you know, put the guy up against the wall. If you ever do that again, you know. And they had that. There was a lot of examples, I guess, of what you might call local rough justice. And it didn't really matter if somebody held an official position, you know, with the state or with the local council or where they were a headmaster at the school or whatever, there was a kind of unofficial local justice that superseded it, that even the police in that area knew and turned a blind eye to because they knew what the consequences would be. One story she told me was about this guy who in one of the local pubs there, you know, went to grab this woman who was dancing, went to grab her, you know, somewhere. And she said for the rest of his life, he was not allowed to go to any of the pubs in that region and had to catch a bus 20 miles down the road because nobody, you know, every single person in that town knew what he did and he was never forgiven ever. I guess what I'm saying is these sorts of things existed within the lifetimes and memories of people living today, right? My mother. But within my lifetime, and I was born in the 80s, the very last vestiges were being stamped out. And by this point, the British state basically just does not allow things. Like if they were to do the things that she described now, the things they were doing back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, police would be there like a shot, there'd be health and safety, you know, social services would get involved, you know, maybe the kids would be taken away. And there's all sorts of bits of managerial therapeutic state basically break that more spontaneous order that used to exist. Okay. So I guess one of my questions is, where do you see things like that re-emerging in the current order? Because, like, viewed from a certain point of view, I see the trajectory having gone in my lifetime in the other direction towards greater centralization and officialdom and health and safety and bureaucracy, etc. So anyway, go on.
Sure. So, I mean, I'll avoid talking for the moment about the structural factors, because I think that those are interesting, but they're not precise. They're not really what you're asking about. Historically, certainly, we have seen many, many examples of this, like, local authority. You could think of the medieval free cities, the Swiss cantons, the colonies in North America, the Icelandic Commonwealth, all kinds of things. But we are now seeing this actually in the modern world as well. Right now, at the moment, this is much more visible in the third world. When you look at things like the Mexican cartels, this would be a good example of a para-sovereign, because cartels exercise sovereign functions unofficially. They collect taxes. Now, we don't call it taxes. We call it extortion. They run courts, rough justice, as they settle disputes among themselves. And in some cases, they actually regulate commerce locally. The police and the mayors answer to them. And we actually just saw a huge kerfuffle last week. I believe it was in Mexico over this, where one of the mayors was killed, and there was a number of protests as a result of this. Now, put aside the noise of the protests, what it shows you is basically that the that people are they're frustrated over the cartels themselves, yes, of course, but they're really more frustrated over a sense of state abandonment, I would say. So that's over there, though. You know, we could also think of Lebanon's Hezbollah-controlled areas, the clans in Somaliland, the Italian mafia regions that Mosca talked about. But, you know, we can also look a little bit closer to home as well. There are pockets of sovereignty inside of the American Republic, right? Amish communities, you know, they're not very militant. But they, you know, in some, they really sort of answer very strongly to the world that you described there of your parents when they grew up. Certain mountain and rural really regions like Appalachia and Ozarks and things like that, where de facto local norms dominate over state enforcement. But that's also, that feels a little bit rural as well. What about if we look a little bit closer to the, you know, the center, like urban areas? You could think of places like sanctuary cities in America. Now, these are not exactly governed by the local sheriff, but they certainly do openly defy federal immigration law. And this institutional fragmentation sort of naturally is empowering the local political blocs. Mm-hmm. You can, and similarly, you can look at the state versus federal divergence, right? Like the Texas border enforcement versus the directives from Washington. I go into an example in the book of, you know, the piano wire incident that happened, I believe it was early in 2024. The California environmental regime versus American Environmental Protection Agency, Florida, things like that. Also seeing kind of state abandonment in even like very strong urban areas, or at least large urban areas. Citizen patrols in places like Detroit. Mediation councils, like Sharia mediation councils within Muslim communities. Mm-hmm. And neighborhood watches beginning to replace, not replace, but supplement, like, you know, police action in U.S. cities, parallel schooling structures, things like, you know, ultra-Orthodox schools, homeschool networks. Now, these are the beginning of what you're seeing, what I believe you're going to see very much strongly, more strongly in the future. And of course, you know, modern regimes have crushed local authority unusually fast, because they understand as almost uniquely only it seems that the radical right does, that you have to capture rival castles. Basically, governments have this centralized administrative capacity, surveillance networks, instant ability to mobilize police. They can exercise, you know, choke points in the financial system, like with the trucker rally in Canada. They can coordinate media, you know, responses and things like that. But there's a few interesting examples, I would say, of modern localism that was seen as a threat, like the Bundy Ranch standoff, right? Mm-hmm. Where these local ranchers attempted to assert quasi-sovereign control over federal land. Now, they were able to push back substantially, briefly. But, of course, the leaders were arrested, and then the movement was dismantled within a few weeks. Local defiance, I would say, and other examples would be like in the COVID era, right? You know, where some counties and councils and things tried to ignore mandates, and they were met with, you know, police deployments in some cases and funding withdrawal and all of that.
I've noticed on some of these examples, you know, the state just does not wish to tolerate, and others they do. I mean, I know of some initiatives of people like wanting to buy land and things like that. And of course, if they're white, they get all sorts of pushback and they're called all sorts of names. Whereas I've noticed that the liberal order, and even I've noticed like people like Tony Blair will talk about this as well, they do talk about communities when it comes to ethnic minorities. Like, for example, about 20 years ago, there was a whole conversation in this country about how the black community does not respond to the police in the normal way, right? That they don't, like, I don't know, let's say if you saw someone neighbor doing a crime or something, you'd ring the police, wouldn't you? Whereas in that community, there's a culture of just like not trusting the authorities or not contacting them, or a culture where, I don't know, you don't snitch on your mate and things like that. And that was a whole conversation. I remember in the late 90s, that was a whole conversation around the black community. And then more recently, you know, you mentioned like Sharia law and things like that. There has been, I mean, there's obviously the grooming gang scandal in this country. But part of that conversation has been, or part of the complaint that some people have is that the Muslim community, quote unquote, or the community leaders didn't turn in, or they weren't responsible. They kind of helped, they kind of, in a way, turned a blind eye, or they didn't cooperate with the authorities, or they didn't. And one of the odd things about that is that there's a contradiction within liberalism there, because all of a sudden, the Muslim community is treated as a collective as opposed to as this is a bunch of different individuals doing it. There is actually an expectation for the community to have some like self-policing. So in a way, it's already kind of baked in, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, it is. Liberalism is happy to deputize rival castles when they're not a threat. So, the thing about the Muslim community is that there is absolutely no potential for mass mobilization. Now, you and I understand very well, and the audience understands very well, that mass mobilization is something that does not happen from the bottom up. This is something that is a top-down, elite-driven phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Now, be that as it may, though, the fact is that a large mass of people who are very angry and who have a unified, cohesive identity, at least a roughly cohesive identity, is a kind of inertial mass that is waiting essentially to be aimed at a rival. And there is really only one, or, you know, for the most part, let's just say for all practical purposes, there is only really one mass like that in modern Western societies, and that is the native European populations of these societies, right? They have the potential to be mobilized essentially to effect a, let's just say, middle low versus high, right? They're the low in the middle low versus high. So on the one hand, the center is very wary of this. They don't want that particular block to be able to be deputized. And they're also very wary of the middle, the intermediaries that might be, you know, willing to mobilize them on their own behalf. And one of the points that David Betts makes that I think is actually pretty sound is that according to the war studies and insurgency literature, the potential for revolution or the potential for a regime change is fairly low at the edges, right? Like if society is extremely fragmented, the coordination costs are simply too high. It's impossible basically to mobilize anybody of any significance. And so, you know, you can play a kind of Bismarckian game of rail politic to keep everything down. However, if fragmentation is too low, then you're also not going to get a revolution because people are essentially cohesive and happy and living in a society that they're pleased with, right? So you don't have the popular discontent that is immobilizable. It's somewhere in the middle that you get the problem, right? Where society is fragmented enough that people are pissed off, but it's cohesive enough that you can mobilize a large chunk of the population to do something about that. So my contention is that the replacement narrative and all of the things that, you know, people point to as like tyrannical overreach of the government trying to stomp on the native populations is essentially an attempt to speed run the fragmentation process to where it's at a point where it cannot be, it's not possible essentially for the regime change to happen. So I think that's why you get this anarcho-tyranny, you get this, frankly hypocritical approach to these problems, right? Where it's solidarity for me, but not for thee.
Can I ask you a question, though? Because some people watching this who've been propagandized by the counter-jihad, which is very strong in this country, Tommy Robinson et al., would probably have heard you said, oh, hold on a second, you said the Muslim community are not mobilizable. Why do you say that? Because they would argue, look, it's jihad waiting to happen, etc. Why do you dismiss the possibility of the Muslims doing something, quote unquote?
Well, it's because they're simply not large enough of a community. They don't have the mass inertia that the native population does. Certainly, they could. They have a their own form of grievance politics, but you know, if you look at the potential for mobilization in the white community. Yeah, I mean, just look at what happened with the Southport riots, right? Like that was something that was actually spontaneous, as far as I can tell. I'm not aware of any coordination there. And that was, the regime was very spooked by that. You can tell because of the legal response to it, right? With the sentencing guidelines. Now, those were walked back, of course, because that is completely delegitimizing. But they were really freaked out by it, and they were right to be freaked out by it, because imagine if that mass of energy had essentially been pointed in a direction and coordinated. That's the stuff that nightmares are made of for the regime. The Muslim community simply doesn't have the mass. I mean, they could be mobilized, but they just don't have the mass that the native population does. And it really doesn't take a lot for, as I mentioned before, the asymmetry of war, the asymmetry of conflict today is such that it favors small actors. So it really actually doesn't take a large contingent of people to, say, create a series of cascading energy crises or blackouts or, you know, the number of cell towers knocked out and things like that, that would completely essentially paralyze a modern society, or certainly send it into an economic downturn. Now, that might seem to fly against what I just said in terms of, well, the Muslim population is just not that large. And certainly they could be perhaps mobilized to do something like that. But why would they do that? All of their enclaves are urban, and they would be the ones to suffer if something bad like that were to happen, if people were basically to do a kind of, you know, terrorism fundamentally, right? And to attack city infrastructure and things. This would be sort of, you know, cutting off their own nose, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whereas the native ethnic populations in these societies are much more rural, much more sort of resilient, at least in terms of caloric independence. So it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that the that particular ethnic community, like the native or the ethnic minority communities, would be able to reach a potential that would be troubling to the state. If anything, they make much better client networks or client groups, basically.
Well, they are a client group. Let's face it, they are a client group of the ruling class.
Yeah, of course, it takes for the client group is to deny them certain certain, you know, goods that they have been given, like, you know, in terms of like welfare and in terms of anarcho-tyranny, like basically like turning a blind eye legally towards some of what's been going on and everything. So it would be very easy for the state to just basically sort of turn off the taps and say, okay, you're done. It's much harder to do that against the native population, because of course that's what they've been doing for, you know, at least 30 years now. And these native populations have grown resilient and resentful. So, you know, they're kind of running out of time to fix this problem. And what they're trying to do is essentially to fragment society to a degree where it's actually impossible for these like majority populations to fight back.
So two further questions. One, again, along these lines of trying to identify pockets of feudalism, I guess, in the system. And I don't know if you discuss this anywhere in the book, but more than once I've looked at figures like Elon Musk, even Donald Trump, who is kind of very monarchical as a figure, but Elon Musk and some of the other tech billionaires as well. And you know, if you're familiar with Curtis Yarvin's work, I know he's less trendy these days, but you know, it's all kind of like a modern Thomas Carlyle, captain of industry type thing, where if you think about Elon Musk with his 100 million followers on Twitter or wherever it is, 200 million followers on Twitter, there is a kind of feudal thing going on there. Do you see these sorts of figures being a factor? Back in the day, I made a video explaining why I'm not an anarcho-capitalist, because I thought that a figure who I called the Car King, you know, like a tycoon, like a billionaire, would end up recreating the functions of the state, right, within some sort of enclave. You know, maybe he starts providing housing for his workers or something, and de facto he's already their sovereign. Do you see any power, sovereign power, accruing to figures like this, to the Elon Musks or Bill Gates or any of these other kind of billionaire tycoon types, oligarchs, I guess you'd call them?
Yeah, I do. And this is not something that's really actually all that new. You can think of actually the war studies scholar Barbara Walter talks about what she calls ethnic entrepreneurs, which are elites who are essentially business people who catalyze conflict. She speaks specifically in her book about Slobodan Milosevic and Franjo Tudjman. I could have the pronunciation wrong, but these are basically the figures in the Yugoslav conflict that they essentially fuse a grievance narrative with a narrative of superiority, like our people have been wronged, but we're still, you know, destined for greatness and everything like that. And once that message catches on, it's very combustible. Now, of course, Elon Musk and Donald Trump are not they're not blowing ethnic dog whistles, at least, you know, not if you're a sane person. You don't think that. Maybe somebody on
I don't know, Mike. I don't want to sound like a hysterical BBC news anchor here, but it was only a couple of months ago that Elon Musk appeared on a stage with Tommy Robinson via satellite and said, look, you got to take to the streets, otherwise it's over, civil war, blah blah blah. So he certainly seemed to be rabble rousing.
Yeah, and
hold on. There's even a clip, Mike. I hate to get all like tawdry and into the world of, but this is like a member of the British government talking to Elon Musk. Hold on.
Get the hell out of our politics and our country.
I mean, if that is not, he's talking about Elon Musk there after he appeared on that stage.
Yeah.
I mean, is that not what you're talking about? It's elite conflict on one level, but it's also, I mean, he's sensing a rival castle, isn't he? He's sensing a threat to the sovereignty of the British state coming from a billionaire, the world's richest man.
Yeah, absolutely. I can certainly see that. I don't think that Elon Musk, I mean, maybe in his heart, he is from South Africa, let's be honest. So, I mean, maybe in his heart, he understands where things are heading. But I think he is a, Elon, sticking with Elon for a second, I think he is a meritocrat. I think he honestly believes in this stuff, or at least, I don't know, I'm not a mind reader. But you don't have to believe that he is a an ethnic entrepreneur to kind of see the structural position that he occupies in society. And you know, to your point there, I mean, Trump just the other day was calling for remigration. And my belief is that he either used the term remigration or reverse migration. So these things are starting to gain currency in contemporary politics, things that would have been unthinkable even 5 years ago, much less 10 years ago. My view is that the center, the regime, whatever you want to call it, is basically trying to stabilize the situation, trying to keep the ship from capsizing because of there is too much nepotism, ethnic nepotism inside of corporate culture. People are noticing, there's a huge amount of noticing going on, and people are calling for this. And basically what they're, I believe, trying to do is I think that the center basically understands that there is such an incredible degree of ethnic nepotism within the broader economy, especially the financialized economy, that we are really, really sacrificing competence for this nepotism, and that this is a big problem. It's actually a threat to sovereignty, right? So I think that's the it's not anything to do with ethnic solidarity. It's everything to do with stabilizing society and remaining competitive vis-a-vis China and Russia and all that.
That's why I've said before, is that you better hope Tucker Carlson is CIA. Because, I mean, this is what he'd be engaged. This is what he's talking about, really. This is what he's got. If you take him seriously, he is desperately trying to stabilize America, you know, before it's too late, by drawing attention to exactly what you've been talking about.
Yeah, and it's a legitimate problem. It's something that we absolutely, you know, we in the West, as collectively and separately, need to deal with, because otherwise, I mean, it is a world of multipolarity, and it's a problem for us. We can't coast on, you know, the U.S. dollar very much longer. So anyway, to kind of bring it back to the rival castle, the entrepreneur thing, you can look at the rise of things like digital and financial mafias as well. Like if these things, if the Elon Musks of the world and the Donald Trumps and, you know, these, the Peter Thiels and the entrepreneurial element of the right, shall we say, the center right, doesn't prevail, you're going to see this start to move outside of the legal order. And that is a big, big problem. These digital and financial mafias and cyber cartels and everything like that, this is a huge problem as well. The crypto networks that replicate the same logic of parasovereignty online, like, for example, you saw once the Russia-Ukraine war kicked off, basically what you saw was a huge spike in cyber attacks against American assets, both public and private. So this is a kind of fifth generation war going on with plausible deniability. And so if we don't get this under control within the with official structures, even if they are, you know, intermediaries, this is going to move outside of the legal order, and that's going to be a huge problem for us, and it's just going to be a huge problem globally. So, you know, we really, as a civilization, need to get this under control. But it's, you know, I hate to black pill, but, you know, I'm trying to be a realist here. I'm trying not to say what ought to be, but to look reality square in the face and see what actually is going on. I don't see us being able to put this back into the bottle, right? Because there are so many, there are just so many structural problems. You know, as I mentioned, we have the energy crisis, right? Like isn't it past peak oil almost certainly in 2018 or right thereabouts, right? That in itself is a huge problem.
I was going to ask about this because I remember that Joseph Tainter, you draw on, is very big on the peak oil stuff. And I know that some people who watch this, especially coming from that more kind of libertarian end of things, would be like, well, look, the energy crisis is self-inflicted. That, you know, the West did not have to embark on climate change nonsense and green energy and so on. And that actually, if we just had some sensible people here and we reopen the coal mines, and we'd be good to go for another couple of hundred years. What would you say to somebody? Because I know people who are very big on that topic. What would you say to those sorts of arguments against notions of peak oil or notions of energy crisis? Like, i.e., scrap all the net zero stuff and we're rocking and rolling again.
Well, I guess what I would say is it seems to ignore history and it seems to ignore physics, ultimately. The problem of the economy is a problem of physics because, you know, fundamentally money is not a unit of exchange or, a stand-in for barter or anything like that. Money is fundamentally a call on energy. And we have been living for 500 years or more beyond our means. Ultimately, the modernity was only made possible by the discovery of the new world and the opening up of a vista of cheap and abundant and seemingly endless energy in the form of timber first and then coal and then oil. And we've just gone through it. We've eaten through it, right? We're like the trust fund kid that has completely built a consumptive life for himself that is, we're just unable to maintain it. We just are. I'm sorry.
I don't want to get too bogged down into this, but I just got to like push back a little bit. Okay. So what if somehow Nigel and Donald and et cetera find the balls and the energy to send them all back, right? So you're getting upwards of 10 to 20 million people leaving Britain in the next couple of decades. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm just putting a hypothetical, right? Did you have breakfast this morning, Mike? Right? I was just trying to put a hypothetical here, okay? And you'll get the same thing happening across the West. A big exodus, a big mass remigration, okay? And then you also decouple the economy from all of these kind of psychopathic models of growth, right? Everybody is addicted to the idea of growth. And you simply say, look, we're going to do with Japan. We're going to let the population decline. We're going to let demographic and the economy is going to readjust. In those conditions, would we not then have enough energy and we'd scrap net zero, et cetera? Would we not then have enough energy to eke out a couple more centuries?
Well, let me first say that I don't think green energy is a thing at all. Just to, you know, agree, mm-hmm. first of all, start from a point of agreement. That's a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
But what you would have to do, even if you had all of that stuff in place, even if all the cultural problems were solved, you would have to wind back the financialization of the economy. I mean, ultimately, what you're seeing now is that there are too few productive outlets and money essentially chasing too much lack of productivity, right? Like the high energy surplus allowed finance to chase returns all over the place and still find real productivity to capitalize on. But the fact is that the real economy actually is struggling. And this is why, you know, they feel poorer than they ever have been, because they actually are. So we would need to wind back the financialization of the economy. We would need to reindustrialize. We would need to start building nuclear at a pace that is absolutely like gangbusters. You know what I mean? Because, mm-hmm. I mean, just think about it. Like back in, I think it was about 1920 or so, somewhere between 1915 and 1930, the return on investment for energy.
You've cut up a bit there, Mike. Sorry.
It was something like 1,000 to 1.
You've roboted up there a little bit.
Okay. Back in about 1910 or 1920 or so, the return
still,
on investment.
Still roboting, Mike. Sorry.
Okay. Can you hear me now? Am I coming through? Am I coming through now?
Roboty for some reason.
Okay.
Must be from your end. I'll have to cut this bit out.
Sorry, just a second here. I may need to. What's going on here?
Is there something open? I don't know.
Can you hear me? Am I coming through now?
No, it's still very roboty, Mike.
Okay, just give me a second. I'm going to reconnect to a different network.
Oh, you're fine again now. Bizarrely.
I'm back?
Yeah, you're back.
All right. So I'll start off where I left off. In about 1920, give or take, you know, 5-10 years, the return on investment for energy exploration was 1,000 to 1. Today it's 5 to 1. This is a huge problem because peak oil is not just about like, oh, well, now we need to use less. This energy inefficiency starts a whole cascade, because you need to spend a certain amount of energy to get this energy that's required. And so what you get ultimately is not just like, you're not just going to start to have to tighten the belt. You're going to start to get things like brownouts, and energy is just not going to be available. Like, you know, the whole economy relies upon like, you know, petrol and gasoline and coal and ultimately oil. So you're just not going to be able to run the economy at the scale that we have done for a very long time. And this underwrote, as I mentioned, the financialized economy, but it also underwrites the bureaucracy, because bureaucracies were built and expanded in a high energy, high growth context. When you have less energy surplus, there is less money, you know, to underwrite competence and long time horizons and investment over decades and redundancies and things like that. So with this slower or like, you know, less energy input, the public sees increasing friction. Everything feels a little bit slower and more broken, and decisions appear to be more arbitrary. And of course, energy input also underwrote, you know, what the libertarian calls voluntarism, right? Like when the pie is growing, you can afford things like pluralism. You can afford things like, you know, some lack of consensus. You can afford tolerance and things like that. But when people, you know, don't feel that their quality of life is rising, or certainly when they feel it falling, their anxiety starts to rise and they begin to narrow their solidarities. And you get generosity towards outgroups begins to fade. This is, you get the collapse of what's called bridging social capital. Mm-hmm. So all of these things, like even if we were to get rid of all of our social problems, as you've mentioned in your hypothetical there, we would still run into this issue of a collapsing thermodynamic base. And of course, an industrial economy depends upon this. It depends upon the abundance of high density energy inputs. So, I mean, you know, contrast the...
There is a question I must ask you about this, mm-hmm. which is that as a connoisseur of Tony Blair and Klaus Schwab's fourth industrial revolution, and I'm sure Elon Musk and Marc Andreessen and Larry Ellison and all these people, their silver bullet to all of this just seems to be saying AI over and over again. AI is going to shrink the state. AI is going to fix it. AI is going to, you know, we're not going to need all of this energy that you're talking about because AI. How do you answer that question? Because it's bound to come up in the comments, etc.
Sure. Well, I mean, a couple of reasons. First of all, let's just put aside the question of AI as solving social problems. Let's just talk about hard material economic problems. First of all, AI is extremely energy intensive. It takes the equivalent of a small city to run an AI data center there and a comparable amount of water. They're extremely energy intensive, and this is a huge problem. So even just running the AI is an issue. And the second issue is that, like, is AI really going to run your industrial economy for you? I don't think it is, right? I don't see that. Like, is AI going to be farming the crops? Well, sure. Okay. It can do that, but it's still going to require energy inputs at the same scale or roughly the same scale as is required to support the economy today. It's just going to be done automatically, and the people are going to be able to, you know, in their vision, the people are going to be able to relax and pursue other things rather than hard field work, but it's still going to require energy. So you can't, like, you still need to have, like, the economic pyramid is always going to be what it is. It's just a hard material fact of reality. At the bottom, you've got the primary industries, like things like resource extraction and agriculture and things like that. Just above that, you've got manufacturing, a little bit less. Above that, you've got things like retail, a little bit less than that. Above that, you've got things like media and entertainment. And above that, you've got things like governance and ideological indoctrination. It seems like the gambit of the modern liberal state is to invert that pyramid completely. And of course, by doing that, they still have to run into reality. So ultimately, the effective economy must always adhere to that pyramid. So all this means is that our effective economy is entangled with other economies that fill out the base of the pyramid, such as China and Russia and other industrialized economies like Germany and things like that. So really, this attempt to use AI to solve all these problems, or let's just say forget about AI for a second, the post-industrial economy is by necessity a globalist economy. And that globalist economy is feeding into all the problems that we were just saying, suppose that these were all solved. So It's really the post-industrialism that is the problem. We have to go back to a more of an industrial economy, really. And if we're going to have discrete nations, we have to have some degree of autarky. And if we're going to have autarky, then that means, you know, ultimately an industrial base. And if we're going to have an industrial base, we need energy. So I just don't see how we escape this problem ultimately.
The last question I'll ask along the similar sort of lines is that the thinking of the Davos class, Tony Blair's of this world, people in this country who support the EU, right, who vote to remain and things like that. I mean, I've got a friend, good buddy, who sincerely, or at least he did last time I spoke to him, believes in this kind of thing. That actually, yes, you're right, Mike, the nation state is on its way out, right? But only because the next step in evolution is towards the big macro post-national superstructure, European Union, and then even beyond that, one world government. How do you answer those people? Like, why would the trajectory go towards, you know, retribalization, feudalization, as opposed to one world government?
Well, there's a number of reasons, I think. Why don't we talk about one? Let's talk about the asymmetry of conflict, because ultimately all, nations or all, you know, whatever you want to call them, polities or societies or however society, human society is organized, has to be able to defend itself. It has to basically be able to exercise decisionism. It has to be able to decide the exception. That's ultimately what sovereignty is. And this means being able to wage war, ultimately. And the way that war has changed over a long period of time, such that it now favors the smaller actors, right? As I mentioned before, you know, we begin with in the war studies, in war studies, we begin with the first generation in the Napoleonic era, line and column warfare. This requires a large state for fairly obvious reasons. The second generation is essentially the World War II artillery era. This requires also a very large state, in fact, more, because you need an industrial base. The third generation is essentially maneuver warfare, blitzkrieg from late World War II onward. And this is kind of the height of, state capacity, because you need like a degree of mechanization and coordination that only states can muster. But this begins a turn towards in the other direction, because just the nature of command in this form of warfare rewarded adaptability and decentralized decision making. Essentially, it was so fast that you had to basically let your lower order commanders make decisions on the fly. In the next generation, which is guerrilla warfare, non-state actors start to fight states asymmetrically, because the battlefield is everywhere. Now, the battlefield is not necessarily, you're not fighting with a musket and a bayonet along a very discrete line. You're fighting in cities. You're fighting on social media. You're fighting in culture, ultimately. And legitimacy becomes as important as firepower, right? So what happens here is that all of a sudden a tank or a jet becomes a lot less useful when you're fighting a decentralized insurgency force and you're waging a war of attrition. This is why the Vietnamese were able to rebuke and fight off the Americans. And it's why this same thing happened in Afghanistan, right? Fifth generation sort of extends that into information warfare, where now we get into things like lawfare and disinformation narratives, economic warfare, and things like that. So this is very strongly pushing back against globalism. I think that globalism was really at its height sort of before Web 2.0, just as Web 2.0 was coming in. I think that's really will historically be looked at as the peak of globalism. But what Web 2.0 did was it essentially decentralized information networks. And this is an important part of exercise. It's an important sovereign function, is basically telling people what to believe and narratives about who we are and what we're doing and where we ought to go and all of that. That's been balkanizing. And it's been balkanizing because of technology with the internet. It's been balkanizing, as I mentioned earlier, with postmodernism and ultimately all this descending from the Enlightenment. But basically, I think that, the Davos Man crowd is much weaker than it has been in a long time. Much weaker than it has been, at least within, 15 years or so. Mm-hmm. Whether that's a long time, it depends. But I just don't think that momentum is moving in their direction at all. Now, they do have AI and surveillance, and that is an important centralizing counterforce. We can certainly talk about that stuff. But I think ultimately, technology is moving against them. This is why you see the rise of nationalism. And I think nationalism is actually only a stage, and you're going to see further devolved movements beyond that. And we're starting to see that with the advent of these parasovereigns, these little nodes of sovereign decision that certainly can't challenge the state, but they can't challenge the state as an alternative to it, but they can exercise some degree of decision within their little ambit. Mm-hmm. I just don't think, I think Tony Blair is I think his heyday has come and gone. obviously globalism is still very powerful, but I just see all the structural forces moving against it.
So last question, Mike, is that, we are both dads. Okay. And okay. We're trying to talk about what is, not what ought to be. Right. But we can talk about what we should hope for our lives, for the lives of our children, etc. And this is a more difficult question, I suppose. In the short term, i.e. in the term of, for the rest of our lives, should we hope for the centralizing powers to restabilize long enough for, our kids to have relatively normal lives? Or should we hope for the opposite and for the collapse of all of this?
Yeah, well, I mean, that is a very difficult question. No father wants to see his child grow up in an environment of instability, where you might end up in a Sharia court at some point.
Yeah.
That's not a good thing. I think that there are things that we can hope for if we see it, if fragmentation continue. That we are going to move into a world of much stronger family bonds. We're going to move into a world of local resilience. I think the elite landscape is going to be far more transparent than it has been in all of our lifetimes. And there's going to be some practical autonomy in our everyday lives, at least for the folks who are able to push back and maintain some sort of local sovereignty. I honestly, I honestly think that centralization, there is a logic to, there's a certain logic to devolution, a certain historical logic. We kind of need this. And part of the problem is that centralization has gone on so far that for it to devolve now seems like it would be a catastrophe. But this, if the centralization continued on further, the tragedy would be yet worse, because it is going to happen. There's no doubt in my mind about that. If centralization continued, we would see much more bureaucratic control over ourselves as parents. I'm speaking sort of from a father's perspective here. We would see more control over parenting. We as fathers would lose influence. We are losing influence. The state would essentially expand into a co-parent even more than it already has. We would have perhaps some degree of higher stability, but much less independence. But, you know, centralized states can maintain infrastructure and order and welfare systems and things like that. If things do fragment and devolve, we're going to see much more in the way of local de facto variations. So where you live is going to have a lot to do with how good your life is. Some places will be safe. Some places will be chaotic. Some places will be super ideological, and some will be more sane. There'll be more space for things like homeschooling, like parallel structures, like, you know, religious curricula, mutual aid networks, that sort of thing. But there'll be some downsides to fragmentation. So, I mean, it'll be very uneven, unpredictable. There'll be a lot of inequality between different regions and things like that. I think what what we should hope for is a controlled and partial fragmentation, not a collapse, not a full-on balkanization, and certainly not a civil war, but enough decentralization that local communities can sort of begin to differentiate themselves. We as fathers can get out from under the eye of Sauron and these state norms that are just absolutely poisonous. We're parallel institutions. We can build those institutions, and families kind of have room to breathe. So I think, yeah, this controlled fragmentation is probably the best case scenario for us, because it will be difficult but manageable. So, you know, fathers today, I would like to see our guys, and I encourage our people to build parallel structures, to migrate selectively to places where you are among like-minded people, for us to invest in the cultural formation of our kids, to really take hold of, to shape their worldview, their moral grounding, their identities, to teach them literacy and discipline and to overcome challenges. Because I think the 2030s through the 2040s are going to be a transitional stage. There's not going to be a catastrophe. We haven't really got to talk about it, but I think it's going to be more of a stepwise downgrading. But it is going to be a long and uneven phase where central authority begins noticeably to weaken and new authorities noticeably begin to emerge. And actually, I think that this is a world where fathers matter more than ever. So it's something that we need to take seriously. That is an office of dad that we need to really, really take hold of.
Well, Mike, thanks a lot. Where can people find the book?
Yeah. Thank you very much for having me. You guys can find that on imperiumpress.org. And along with all the other books, including, you know, such fine books as Applied Elite Theory, Populist Delusion, and many others. Chris Bond, for the old school Imperium fans, has a new book out as well. And we actually have reissued his original book, Nemesis. We've got a lot of good stuff that came out at the end of the year. And this year we have added almost 40% to our complete catalog. So it's been a huge year for us. If you guys haven't seen Imperium in a few months or in a year, you're going to be surprised at how much is there now. So, yeah, thank you very much for having me on. It's been a really good chat.
Great. And we're going to speak again really soon. All right. Bye. Bye, Mike.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.